Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Cooper Talks USA. And this week we're going to be looking at affirmative action on the Supreme Court and some looks at race relations in general. Now we're not going to be doing the whole history of affirmative action. We're just mainly going to be looking at how it's changed and the impact of the Roberts Court on affirmative action. So to begin with, a little bit of background history. We go back to Earl Warren. He became Chief Justice in 1953, and he had a huge impact on modern race relations and, in a sense, changed the very nature of the Supreme Court, one of the great examples that people make a big difference in history. He was certainly an activist, certainly a liberal, despite being a former Republican governor of California, and certainly interpretive of the Constitution. And in essence, he has made and shaped modern America, perhaps more than any other person, through the Supreme Court. Now, obviously, what Warren is most known for is the decision in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. Now, in that famous case of 1954, Warren steered his colleagues to a unanimous decision concerning segregation. He wrote, "We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place." Thus the court overturned Plessy versus Ferguson of 1896. Now, it's a bit old, but it is a good example of judicial review. Perhaps what's more interesting or more impressive about it is that Warren actually managed to unite the entire court behind him. That by no means was certain. Some people felt uneasy striking down a previous Supreme Court ruling, justices like Frankfurter. And Hugo Black, although quite a liberal and constitutionalist, was from Alabama and he felt reluctant to overturn it. And yet Warren managed to convince the court to create a unanimous decision which gave much greater weight to the final verdict in Brown versus Board of Education. Now, of course, giving equality and ending segregation to African Americans was a great step forward, but that only provided for equality of opportunity. It meant that in theory, any black children could have the same access to education as any white children. What it did not lead to was equality of results, whereby actually young African-American children would become more equal in society. And in order to achieve that, people started looking around for methods and ways of basically giving African-American children a chance to reach the high standards that they had for so long been denied. And that's one of the key justifications of affirmative action, to make up for the legacies of slavery and segregation. Now, of course, one of the reasons why it was up to the Supreme Court to decide the issue was because politicians in the 1950s were reluctant to go forward on the race issue and make any sweeping statements. So nothing was being done in Congress because the Democrats depended on the Southern vote, who were obviously opposed to reform of segregation. But equally, the Northerners were reluctant to get too involved in the Republican Party. If they were going to win any elections, they needed support from the South. So it was up to the independent Supreme Court to take these decisions. And with the slow development of affirmative action, it was quite often the Supreme Court that was seen as the place to settle it, because politicians either didn't want to criticise affirmative action or go against it in fear of losing possibly black or minority votes. Equally, many people who supported it didn't want to change it or were worried about any attacks to it that might occur in Congress where it potentially could be destroyed. So basically, both sides have left it to the Supreme Court and it's become the centrepiece for these race relations battles. Now, this isn't the place where we're going to look at the whole history and legacy of affirmative action. We're more interested here in the nature of it on the Supreme Court. So we're going to fast forward to the year 2007 with a case called Parents Involved in Community Schools versus Seattle School District Number 1. A bit of a lengthy title. It might be easy just to remember it as the Seattle and Louisville School Board cases. Now, Seattle and Louisville were two very different cities in two very different parts of the country. Each faced a similar problem, though, in the early 21st century. In both Seattle and in Louisville, Kentucky, pupils tended to go to their nearest school. And in both cities, the local neighbourhoods were highly segregated by race. Usually this was linked to personal choices and financial choices or financial availability. Both school boards wanted to nudge enrolment in their schools in a more integrated direction. So let's look first at Seattle's selection process. In Seattle, they had a 41% white student body and 59% non-white. Students could choose their high school in the first place. So they would send in their application to go to high school and they would give their first preference. As a tiebreaker, first criteria was having a sibling there. So if they had too many students, the first way to select students would be if there was a sibling already there. The second tiebreaker was race. If the school's racial makeup was more than 10% different from the whole city, race would determine whether or not a particular student was admitted. So for example, if a black student was applying to a school and the school was oversubscribed, they didn't have a sibling there, then they would look at race and they might say, well, this school has a 52% white student body. That is more than 10% out from the city's representation. Therefore, we are going to allow this black student to attend over this white student. Now, does it make a huge difference? Probably not, but it did affect some people. Louisville's selection process was similar in many ways. The difference being that the first tiebreaker was proximity to the school, but race was still the second tiebreaker. Overall, fewer than 500 students in each city were affected by the race part of the formula. So it's not a major issue, but obviously it did have an impact on those 500. In terms of numbers, it was a small case, but the importance was the issue of affirmative action, which had been mainly the preserve of the Supreme Court, as I've mentioned. It was also the first opportunity for the new look conservative court, where Alito's replaced O'Connor, to address the legacy of Brown. So the key issue that was really being decided on the Supreme Court was Brown essentially a libertarian decision which simply forbade all recognition of race by the government, or did Brown mandate or allow government to take steps to foster integration? Effectively, does Brown allow for equality of opportunity only, or does it allow for equality of results? Can the government get involved, or does the government stay out? So that's kind of the key argument. The things to consider were, when can the government consider race in assigning you to a school or hiring you for a job or assigning you a congressional district? Can the government legally ever consider race at all, or does it need to be, in the words of John Marshall Harlan Sr., colourblind? A colourblind constitution that does not see race. Now, this case came in 2007. Only 4 years before had been a major affirmative action case before the Supreme Court called Grutter versus Bollinger in 2003. Now, this was where O'Connor had decided a 5-4 majority, and she wrote the opinion over the admissions policy of the University of Michigan Law School. In that case, race was one of many factors used in deciding who to admit. It was in line, O'Connor's opinion was in line with the ruling in Back, that's spelled B-A-K-K-E, pronounced Back, or some people say Backy, in 1978, which determined that race could be a factor, but there could not be a set formula to give an advantage purely on the basis of race. So in essence, it's okay, by the Back ruling and the Grutter ruling, it's okay to use race as a tiebreaker, or one of many criteria for deciding a student's suitability, but you couldn't have a quota. You couldn't say 10% of our students must come from a particular ethnic group. That would be wrong. So Connor's verdict said, and I'm quoting here, "Student body diversity is a compelling state interest that can justify the use of race in university admissions. However, it has been 25 years since Justice Powell first approved the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of public higher education." That I'm just referring to there, that was the decision in Back. To go back to the quote, since that time, the number of minority applicants with high grades and test scores has indeed increased. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today. So, what do we make of O'Connor's decision? Well, essentially, it was judge-made law, with no basis in the Constitution or in legislation. The Supreme Court had effectively ruled that affirmative action would end in 25 years' time, which is a huge expansion of power, but also did put this time limit on it. The Supreme Court has been the bastion for race relations claim, mainly because Congress and the executive do not go near it. And here we have the Supreme Court filling that void and making these decisions. The justification for affirmative action has evolved over time. Originally, it was just to create equality or make up for past wrongs, but it's also become the idea in Grutter that racial diversity is a compelling interest, that it's good for students, it's good for universities and employers to have racial diversity to encourage tolerance and different perspectives. So the interpretation of what affirmative action is for has changed over time. Now, the issue in the Seattle and Louisville cases was whether or not O'Connor's verdict was still the law or not in this new look court with Samuel Alito replacing O'Connor. Now, in the Louisville and Seattle decisions, Roberts, who is a brilliant, brilliant writer and has a fantastic knack of picking or coming up with a key phrase that simplifies a complicated topic and makes it easy to understand. Also, he's fantastic at writing effective judgments. So in the decision, Roberts made this assertion. The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Now, who could argue with that logic? The way to end racial discrimination in America is quite simply to stop racial programs such as affirmative action that by their very nature discriminate on the basis of race. Well, the liberals on the court, they were enraged by this decision and they did disagree. John Paul Stevens wrote a very lengthy dissent and I'm going to read parts of it here. The first sentence in the concluding paragraph of his, Roberts, opinion states, before Brown, school children were told where they could and could not go to school based on the colour of their skin. This sentence reminds me of Anatole France's observation, the majestic equality of the law forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, to beg the streets, and to steal their bread. The Chief Justice fails to note that it was only black schoolchildren who were so ordered. Indeed, the history books do not tell stories of white children struggling to attend black schools. In this and in other ways, the Chief Justice rewrites the history of one of this court's most important decisions. Stevens goes on, the court has changed significantly. It was once more faithful to Brown and more respectful of our precedent than it is today. It is my firm conviction that no member of the court that I joined in 1975 would have agreed with today's decision. Now, by Supreme Court standards, that is pretty damning indictment by one of the respected senior members of the court. Of course, Stevens' opinion doesn't matter because, as ever, 5-4, and the Conservatives on this occasion had the votes. So the significance of the Seattle and Louisville cases was we get clear evidence of the impact of Alito replacing O'Connor, this shift in opinion between Grutter in 2003 and Louisville and Seattle in 2007. We get the evidence of Roberts trying to follow more of an originalist philosophy that, following Harlan's example, that the Constitution should be colourblind and that there should be no more discrimination and no advantage provided by the government, effectively arguing for a limited government role. It also, interestingly, ignored the principle of stare decisis, the idea of principle in the law, and that the court's precedents and the court's previous rulings become constitutional through practice, through adherence. So, and it's a difficult argument there, but obviously in 2003, having race as one of many factors was okay. And then in 2007, the court said, no, it's not. And that change of opinion, that ignoring of precedents, was certainly a criticism of the decision in Seattle. Of course, it's worth bearing in mind, there was no respect for stare decisis in Brown versus Board of Education, which overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. So again, whether you hold to stare decisis and the rule of precedent kind of depends on whether you agree with the decisions of the court or not. The other useful thing about it is it's again another demonstration that O'Connor's legacy was being undone. And she certainly felt very strongly that most of the close controversial decisions that have been decided since she retired would have gone differently had she still been on the court. And there's probably some merit to that. Criticism has also mounted since 2007 in the non-Republican media about the unseemly speed of changes on the court. So possibly ironically, the non-Republican media outlets are criticising the court for being conservative activist. That within 2 or 3 years, and certainly if we remember DC versus Heller in 2008, the Supreme Court has basically actively sought to change a lot of the major rules to achieve a conservative agenda. So certainly activist, but instead of in a liberal cause, in a more conservative court. And you could argue this is what the conservative right have been fighting for ever since Roe versus Wade and the issue of abortion on the Supreme Court. Now, before we go forward into a series of two cases, although it count, sort of you can look at it as three cases, we need to just think about how some of the justices stand on affirmative action today. Obviously, we know Roberts believes very much in a limited role for the government and that the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. But what about some of the others? Well, first of all, I'd like to look at Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas was a beneficiary of affirmative action, as he freely acknowledges. He gained admission to Yale Law School, largely at a time because they were trying to increase the diversity of their student body. And he was very critical of this in his memoir, My Grandfather's Son. And he writes, "I felt as though I'd been tricked, that some of the people who claimed to be helping me were in fact hurting me." He talked about the paternalistic big city whites offered you a helping hand so long as you were careful to agree with them, but slapped you down if you started acting as if you didn't know your place. And Thomas bemoans the fact that he had to work hard to expel this idea that he was only there because of his race, and he blames affirmative actions for the humiliations he feels he suffered at Yale and also in his career as a judge and going back to his nomination process. In fact, and he really objects to the fact that people think he only made it onto the Supreme Court because of his race. So Thomas is very much opposed to affirmative action as diminishing his achievements as a justice and robbing him of the true value of what he's managed to achieve. So that's Roberts. Now, there is another clear beneficiary of affirmative action, and that's Sonia Sotomayor. But she actually supports affirmative action. She applied to Princeton and Yale Law School, and she says she is a product of affirmative action because she knows she was only admitted despite lower standardized test scores, being effectively a less qualified student, but gaining admission because she was Hispanic. But she doesn't apologize for it. She says that's the point of affirmative action. It's to open doors for those from minority races and give them the opportunity to succeed that they would be otherwise denied because of their racial background. So Sotomayor's in favour of it, although she's also acknowledged that it can cause problems and create hard question about discrimination and about tolerance and the acceptance of it. But largely she's in favour. Now, Alito, okay, he is Hispanic himself, but hasn't really benefited or been affected by affirmative action. But just over a decade after graduating from Princeton in 1982, and in an attempt to get promotion in the Reagan Department of Justice, where he would have worked for John Roberts, as it happens, Alito wrote that he was particularly proud of his work developing arguments that racial and ethnic quotas should not be allowed. So again, Alito is very clear that racial profiling or affirmative action programs should not be allowed under any circumstances. So again, consistent with his conservative ideology. Now, is affirmative action just about race? Again, this is a bit of a question. Is it just about African Americans? Should it be allowed to include Hispanics? What about other races? And of course, what about gender? When Ruth Bader Ginsburg was left as the only woman on the Supreme Court when Sandra Day O'Connor retired, she said it was like going back to law school, where there were 9 women and 500 men, and she was outnumbered. And she was delighted and thrilled, she said, to not be the lone woman around this place when Sonia Sotomayor was appointed. When she was asked about Sotomayor's self-description as a product of affirmative action, Ginsburg pointedly replied, "So am I." Okay, she explained she was first tenured. She was the first tenured woman at Columbia Law School as a lecturer. She had been hired because of pressure to add women professors. So she got the job purely because she was a woman. But when she got to Columbia, she recalled she was well regarded by her colleagues and they backed her up. So affirmative action, effectively, although it wasn't really affirmative action as we know it, had given Ginsburg the opportunity, but once she'd been given the opportunity, she was respected for who she was and her achievements. So we've got Ginsburg there as a clear supporter of affirmative action. So we move forward now to an interesting case, and one that was initially brought in, argued in 2012, and then given its verdict in 2013. And that's the case of Fisher, Abigail Fisher versus University of Texas, Austin. So at issue in the case of Fisher versus Austin was the idea again of race-based affirmative action for education. And this came to the court, or the ruling was announced 10 years after the Grutter ruling, and essentially the Grutter ruling set the precedent. Race-based affirmative action could be one of many factors when deciding university admissions, at least for 25 years. Now, the way University of Texas carried out affirmative action was it admitted most of its students without any express consideration of race and achieved the diversity by accepting all Texas's students who graduated in the top 10% of their high schools. Now, that was quite clever because by saying we'll take the top 10% of every high school in areas where they had heavy segregation, the top 10% of students in an all-black school would all be black. So it's sort of affirmative action without necessarily being affirmative action. However, to secure what it considered a critical mass of diversity, the university would use race as a tiebreaker, much as we saw in Seattle and Louisville, and that's what was being challenged. Could race still be used as a tiebreaker for university admissions? By Grutter, yes, it could. By Seattle and Louisville, no, it couldn't. So there was a disparity in the court's decisions. And that's why the case ended up coming there. It dealt with a young lady called Abigail Fisher, who believed she'd lost out to less qualified African-American candidates and therefore had been discriminated against on the basis of race. Breyer actually joked during the hearing that he knew time had flown since the Grutter decision, but surely not 25 years. 9 years at most have passed. The other key thing to remember is that Elena Kagan had actually been involved in the case beforehand, so she had to recuse herself. So one of the key liberal justices was not going to be able to cast. Fortunately, though, the Fifth Federal Circuit, which deals with Texas, as we've seen before, had sided with Grutter. Okay, they'd used the court's precedence in Grutter and said, yes, race can be one of many factors, and therefore they had basically denied Abigail Fisher's claims and sided with the University of Texas, Austin. That meant if there was a 4-4 tie, then the court would uphold the lower court's decision. So in essence, it would stay with Grutter and that would be the established precedence. So the key is, could they get one of the four conservatives one of the five potential Conservatives to join the Liberal cause without Kagan there. The hope might have been Anthony Kennedy, but in Gruta, he'd actually voted in the minority. He dissented to the opinion. So, we would have expected here a 5-3 decision upholding Abigail Fisher's claims and effectively ending affirmative action, or the rationale for it that had been established in Gruta. But that's not what happened. Again, giving the lie to claims that the Roberts Court is activist, they actually voted by 7-1 to not give a final verdict. So their decision was not to give a decision. That was a 7-1 ruling, only Clarence Thomas dissented. And what they did was they said the lower court had made a mistake when it deferred to the university's insistence that consideration of race was necessary to achieve diversity. They argued that under Gruta, courts should defer to a university's educational judgment that diversity is essential to its educational mission. But once a university decides to pursue diversity, Fisher requires it to prove in court that the means chosen by the university to attain diversity are narrowly tailored to that goal. So specifically, judges must ultimately be satisfied that no workable race-neutral alternatives would produce the educational benefits of diversity. So what does that mean? It basically means the court saying you need to prove that there's a clear racial profiling here and that a race-neutral alternative wasn't available, arguing that really the case hadn't been made and the court should have looked for further evidence before it became to the Supreme Court. Effectively, what they were doing was they were just pushing it back to the court, the lower court, and saying, you need to make this decision and you need to argue it better. Now, this was the first time this happened, but it's actually revealed something about the way the Roberts Court tends to work. On something that could be potentially big and activist, a major change in the law, they tend not to go all out on the first go. Quite often what they'll do is they'll send a case back to a lower court, or they'll give a very narrow ruling. But within that ruling or that opinion will be a clue or a hint as to how they might want it to be argued in a future case. And then when that case can come back to the Supreme Court, then they will pursue it. Then they might do the activist approach. So if you like, it's putting in a precedent that can uphold a judicial theory later on. And that may well be what was happening here in Fisher. And of course, the Liberal justices sided with it as a way of buying time for affirmative action. Now, again, part of the change of this was in writing the opinion, Kennedy actually took part of his dissent in the Gruta decision and was able to convert it into a majority opinion. So in Gruta, he'd explained that forcing schools to seriously explore race-neutral alternatives would focus their talents and resources on devising new and fairer ways to ensure individual consideration. And these race-neutral programs, he argued, might achieve diversity while avoiding preferment by race, which can be the most divisive of all policies, containing within it the potential to destroy confidence in the Constitution and in the idea of equality. Okay, so he was saying strict quotas definitely not right, and actually using race as a profile isn't the best way forward. And in Gruta, parents involved Anne Fisher, Kennedy again rejects absolute arguments for a colourblind constitution. I think that's the key one. He acknowledges that race is a problem. Race is an issue and it does need solutions. So he's maybe not quite as strong on this as Roberts or Alito have been. However, he does feel that government use of race is a dangerous thing and that it can actually cause more problems than it solves and can damage the Constitution and cause harm. So as far as Kennedy's concerned, the government must prove that the use of race to achieve its goals is strictly necessary, that there is no alternative for creating or promoting racial diversity. And that was kind of Kennedy's opinion in the 7-1 verdict that he ruled about not deciding the case. So it gives a hint as to what he's feeling. There needs to be proof that there is no alternative to a race-based affirmative action. Now, Roberts and Alito sort of joined his opinion and said agreed with it, perhaps knowing that it's going to be quite difficult to prove there is no possible race-neutral alternative. Breyer and Sotomayor also signed up to it. And this unusual grouping around Kennedy's opinion and the fact that the case was one of the last ones to come out of the Supreme Court perhaps suggests that there were a lot of disagreements and a lot of tension behind the scenes of the Supreme Court, and that this was ultimately a compromise ruling. Basically, both sides not quite being able to persuade Kennedy. Perhaps Kennedy was reluctant to get rid of Grutter altogether or abolish affirmative action altogether. Kennedy was reluctant to go that far, whilst also not approving of affirmative action programmes. So both sides agreed to just send it back to the lower court and hope that they could decide it, or at least give a clearer argument in the future. Even Thomas and Scalia joined Kennedy's opinion, but they wrote separately to clarify that they still believe government must be colourblind. So they accepted the procedural grounds that Kennedy wrote about, but they made their position very clear. Scalia's was mercifully very short. In fact, I'll read the whole bit of Scalia's. "To pursue the concept of racial entitlement, even for the most admirable and benign of purposes, is to reinforce and preserve for future mischief the way of thinking that produced race slavery, race privilege and race hatred. In the eyes of government, we are just one race here. It is American." Again, the only one to dissent was Thomas. And Thomas would absolutely try and tear the decisions apart, and he would absolutely go to it. Particularly, he said, "The benighted notion that it is possible to tell when discrimination helps rather than hurts racial minorities is ludicrous. One of the worst forms of discrimination in this nation have always been accompanied by straight-faced representations that discrimination helped minorities." Thomas really went for it all out. He wants to get rid of affirmative action based on his previous experiences. So, in essence, you could argue that for the time being, affirmative action had been saved. The Supreme Court had basically refused to give a judgment and sent it back to the Fifth District to see how they would rule it. And perhaps they might rule it differently, or they might find different arguments. So that was the position of the Supreme Court in 2013. But fast forward 1 year to 2014, and we get the decision of Schwett versus Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. Now, this was to do with affirmative action, as the pressure group supporting it might imply. However, it actually had something to do with federalism here as well. So it sort of covers two areas. The case basically was about whether or not a law passed by proposition in Michigan, which banned race and sex-based discrimination in public university admissions, was constitutional. So the issue here is, could a state, with a popular approval through a proposition, ban a program like affirmative action, or basically overtly ban affirmative action or discrimination on the basis of race or gender in admissions to university? Now, the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action had argued that this was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause from the 14th Amendment and was going against the decisions in the Back case, the Grutter case, and not so much the Fisher case, but was in line with the Fisher case. The Sixth Circuit had heard the case and had agreed that it was unconstitutional. Even though it was approved by the state's voters in 2006, the law was unconstitutional and against Supreme Court rulings. In the Schwett decision, then, the issue was, could a state ban a program of affirmative action? Now, this is a slightly different approach from what we've seen before. Before, we've seen campaigns or pressure groups trying to undermine affirmative action and say affirmative action was unconstitutional. But actually, in line with the abortion issue, we now have attempts to say, okay, it's a constitutional legality. You can have race-based affirmative action, but do you have to have race-based affirmative action? So it's constitutional and it's allowable to have it, but does that mean you must have it? In the same way that the various groups trying to target the abortion laws have stopped saying, okay, let's get the Roe versus Wade decision overturned. Let's just say, well, we'll make it very difficult to get one, but we're not actually going to ban it. Is that constitutional? So with the 14th Amendment, with the Schwett decision, there was a 6-2 ruling that state-based bans on affirmative action confirmed by initiatives or propositions were constitutional. Effectively, a state could decide whether or not to ban affirmative action programs if backed up by a popular referendum, effectively, or an initiative. Now, Roberts wrote the opinion in this case, writing that affirmative action was constitutional, but it was not obligatory, and effectively opened the doors for other states with popular support to ban affirmative action programs. It's a good example of the court granting federalism or granting powers back to the states. States can decide these things. Of course, it does also raise questions about what else they can ban or can't ban. And seems to be slightly out of keeping with the decision in Obergefell as well. But it's more powers back to the states. It's an example of a failed test case. Obviously, Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action were hoping that the court would actually rule in their favour and say that you cannot ban university admissions and affirmative action programmes. But the court went against that. What was perhaps more interesting, that not only is the swing Justice Kennedy siding with the Conservatives, but actually Breyer on this occasion joined with the Conservatives. Perhaps because he believed in it or wanted to find a stronger working majority for the decision, or perhaps because he saw a way of at least allowing affirmative action to continue in some states, even if in other states it could then be abolished, at least preserving something. We don't know Breyer's reasoning for this. We can only speculate. Kagan was recused. So obviously the two that dissented were Ginsburg and Sotomayor. And Sotomayor was absolutely livid. And she wrote, for the first time, she actually read her dissent from the bench, angry and clearly very much opposed to it. So in Schwett, we get the decision that while affirmative action is constitutional and legal, a state doesn't have to allow it to continue. It can be banned. So it's been chipped away at. So that leads us to this year, to the 2015-2016 rulings. And Fisher is now back at the Supreme Court. It's going to be heard again. The Supreme Court's recommendations to the Fifth Circuit have largely, from what I can make of it, been ignored. And they've said, no, we think we've heard the case correctly. We don't think we have made a procedural mistake, and we do think that there is a compelling interest argued here. So they've effectively sent it back to the Supreme Court and said, effectively, the Supreme Court needs to make a decision on this. So how will the Supreme Court go in 2016? Based on the Schwett decision, based on the parents involved, the Seattle and Louisville school boards, and based on the nature of the Supreme Court, it looks like time may well be up for affirmative action. Now, that's not a definite. I am just speculating. At this stage, the arguments haven't yet been heard. But on the basis that the Roberts Court tends to like to send out its messages and its precedents, it has sent two clear warnings about affirmative action. In the first case, in the original Fisher, they gave a clear justification for why it was sent back and showed that they needed the compelling evidence to allow affirmative action to happen. In coming back without the lower court making a decision, without changing its verdict, that compelling interest isn't there, which would suggest that Roberts and Alito and Scalia and Kennedy and Thomas will look to strike down the law and basically overturn affirmative action. And if you look at Schwett, which might have been the bigger key, clearly affirmative action doesn't have to be enforced. So there's another precedent there. And based on that, the groundwork has been laid by the Roberts Court, so it's every chance that affirmative action programs may well be struck down as unconstitutional in 2016. But that is speculation, and that's just a case of watch this space and see. But it could have huge ramifications, particularly as it will be ruled in an election year where race may be a significant factor. So I hope you've got a lot out of that. I hope you've managed to pick up some of the legal arguments that we've been looking at in the last three episodes. Next time, I'm going to be looking at the issue of propositions and initiatives and direct democracy in America and how they've impacted on it. Thank you very much for listening, and I will speak to you next time.